Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Welcome to the Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio 855 on your AM dial. I'm Anne, and I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We'd like to pay our respects to elders past and present and to acknowledge that the material and spiritual connection of Aboriginal people to this land was stolen from them. Each week on the Living Free Show, we showcase one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drug, alcohol, gambling, food, and any other addiction you'd like to name or come on and talk about. Our guests share their recovery stories and highlight that shared experience saves lives. Before we start, I'd like to remind you that the Living Free Show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm, and family violence. Please practice self-care and care of others when listening. And hello, Michael.
Hello, good to be here again.
That's Michael. As you know, Michael is the co-host of this show, and Michael's in the studio because we're going to have a chat about basically what he, as a person who was once in the grip of addiction to alcohol, what would he say to a person close to him who's in the grip of the project of getting them to stop drinking?
Yeah, it sounds like hard work, doesn't it?
The project?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, it was. So the big question that a lot of people are living with an active alcoholic or other addict, the big question that preoccupies them, and it preoccupies them, you know, really preoccupies them, how do I get this person sober?
Yeah, I think that actually, if I even looked at my own past, is the amount of energy that I've expended trying to change other people's behaviour anyway. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be addictive behaviour, because I would always think that my special skill is changing your mind, and I work out a whole different series of ways of doing that. I'm manipulative, I'm selfish, I'm self-centred. I need to get an outcome that makes me feel comfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
And I spend so much energy trying to get that done, thinking that if I just apply a bit more will there, if I just tried that, there's a bit in the book. I've got the book Alcoholics Anonymous in front of me, but there's some sections of it's on the pages 60 to 63 in the book. I get referred to it, back to it all the time by my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I try and run the show. And I think it applies to anybody, this way that I try. No, what's the language I can read it? Are you happy for
Please
me to read something?
It,
yeah,
Michael.
Yeah. It's actually.
While you're looking for it, I just want to say, look, the whole work, it's not just people around addiction or in the middle of addiction. This is a normal thing for human beings to think that they know better than other human beings. It just gets a bit crazy with the in the alcoholic situation.
Oh yeah, I think
it goes. Nuclear.
Yeah, well, the whole idea is that it drives me insane.
Yeah.
And for me, as an alcoholic who treats their alcoholism with alcohol, you know, I've got to try and treat it with something else. And so it says the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And on that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. And that bit stands out to me. Even though my motives are good, most people try to live by self-propulsion. And each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show.
Everyone else is on their stage.
Yeah. So the actor has one job, and the job is to read the lines that they're given. Like they just said, that's it.
Yeah.
But he is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way.
Well, I'm usually reading other people's lines for them.
Yep.
Making it up in my own mind and then responding in my own mind.
Oh.
That's real complicated.
Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah, I wish I kept it in my own mind. That would have been excellent. And I said, and if only my arrangements would stay put, if only people would do as I wished, the show would be great. and everybody, including me, would be pleased, and life would be wonderful. And in trying to make these arrangements, the act of me may sometimes be quite virtuous. I may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. But on the other hand, I might be mean, egotistical, selfish and dishonest. But as with most humans, I'm likely to have varied traits. And so this idea that I'm going to be able to get somebody else to do something I think has been in their best interests is absolutely the foundation of when I'm in active addiction. I need them to get off my case. I need them to leave me alone. I don't want to point the finger and deflect, and I don't want anybody to talk to me about my drinking. And I need, if they just settle down, can't they see that I'm paying the bills? Can't they see I'm doing this? Can't they see I'm doing this? I'm looking after the things that I think are important, and I do so much stuff just to try and get them to do something that I want them to do, just to get an outcome, so I feel comfortable.
Yep. And that's what they're doing as well. So we in Al-Anon, we call this the family disease, because we're all doing it.
Yeah.
We're all engaged in exactly that activity that you're talking about, because everyone in the system thinks that they know the best way to deal with the problem.
Absolutely. And it tells me in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it tells me that the problem is self-centeredness. I think the world revolves around me, and so therefore, if you could just do what I want, it'll be all I've got it covered.
Yep.
And I love the bit that I have highlighted in my book, says, even though my motives were good, because my motives are quite often good. It's just the way I go about getting it done isn't. I end up doing it in a way that hurts other people. I step on the toes of others and they retaliate.
Mm-hmm.
And because everybody else has got their own plan.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience of coming, and then watching people trying to get other people sober, I do it as a sponsor of people thinking that I have some power over getting people sober, and it's to stop their particular addiction. And I have no power.
All right. What I'm going to read out now, Michael, you've set the stage. I'm going to set the stage again about, this is an open letter from an alcoholic, and it's a piece of Al-Anon literature, I think. I don't know, is it also in the big book? I don't know. Anyway, listen to this, Michael, and then I'll get you to respond. This is an open letter from the alcoholic. I am an alcoholic. I need your help. Don't lecture, blame, or scold me. You wouldn't be angry with me for having cancer or diabetes. Alcoholism is a disease too. Don't pour out my alcohol. It's just a waste, because I can always find ways of getting more. Don't let me... I'll read it all out and then I'll get you to respond.
I'm just going to keep nodding.
Yeah. Don't let me provoke your anger. If you attack me verbally or physically, you will only confirm my bad opinion about myself. I hate myself enough already. So this is the alcoholic speaking. Don't let your love and anxiety for me lead you into doing something that I ought to do for myself. If you assume my responsibilities, you make my failure to assume them permanent. My sense of guilt will be increased and you will be resentful. Don't accept my promises. I'll promise anything to get off the hook. But the nature of my illness prevents me from keeping my promises, even though I mean them at the time. Don't make empty threats. Once you've made a decision, stick to it. Don't believe everything I tell you. It may be a lie. Denial of reality is a symptom of my illness. Moreover, I'm likely to lose respect for those I can fool too easily. Don't let me take advantage of you or exploit you in any way. Love cannot exist for long without the dimension of justice. Don't cover up for me or try in any way to spare me the consequences of my drinking. Don't lie for me, pay my bills, or meet my obligations. It may avert or reduce the very crisis that would prompt me to seek help. I can continue to deny that I have a drinking problem as long as you provide an automatic escape from the consequences of my drinking. Above all, do learn all you can about alcoholism and your role in relation to me. Go to open AA meetings when you can, attend Al-Anon meetings regularly, read the literature, and keep in touch with Al-Anon members. They're the people who can help you see the whole situation clearly. I love you. You are alcoholic.
Wow.
Do you want me to go through that bit by bit, or do you want to come in on something that jumped out?
No, I'd just like to know when it was written, actually.
I don't know because I've just copied it. I don't know. I don't even know where it appears. It's old.
Yeah, it's old. It's really blunt. It's not
old and blunt, and it's it's been around since Bill and Lois.
Oh, right. So we're talking about the mid-1900s.
Mid-30s. So what do you reckon? I'm just going to go through each one because these are the things that that Al-Anon people do before they get to Al-Anon, possibly after sometimes too.
So Al-Anon is... What's Al-Anon?
Al-Anon, glad you asked, is for families of alcoholics.
Okay.
And most people that have been in a family with an alcoholic have done, and this is me included as a child, I did my fair share of lecturing,
mm-hmm.
blaming, and scolding my father. Can you, as an alcoholic, say what impact that would have on you and whether it would get you to stop drinking?
So I have a really, you know, my defense system, really. I know myself that my drinking is different to other people. I know that I watch the way I drink because, when I'm, I can tell a pretty basic story, but when I'm 18 years old and I'm drinking with other 18-year-olds and I'm rolling around on the front lawn and throwing up in the gutter, that's pretty funny. And then when I'm 25-year-old and I've got to find some 18-year-olds to drink with so I can roll around on the front lawn and throw up in the gutter, that's doable. But when I'm 35 years old and I've got to find 18-year-olds who drink like me, who are rolling around on the ground and throwing up in the gutter, that's creepy and weird. And so I know by the time I'm in my mid-30s, probably in my mid-20s, that my drinking is different to everybody else, but I don't want to be told by you. Like, because I know. And I'm really ashamed of it. I'm in a cycle where my experience in the cycle is that I pick up a drink, it gets out of control. I don't plan to get drunk, but then I'm drunk because I have this physical difference. I don't know that until I come to AA that I'm physically different, that I can't control how much I take. But then I get to, I do some stuff that I'm really ashamed of because that's what happens when we're drunk. It's a social lubricant. It breaks down our ability to stick to our morals. And so I come to in the morning or I wake up and I go, I'm not going to do that again. And the issue is that I do it again. And so because I'm stuck in that cycle, mm-hmm. I know and I feel shame and guilt and remorse about the things I've done, and then to have the people I care about telling me. So I don't really care if someone else tells me, like if their opinion doesn't matter, but, my wife or my kids or my parents or the people around me are pointing out to me that this behaviour is unacceptable.
Bloody obvious.
Bloody obvious, yeah. I've got this wall up and my special skill is to deflect it and point the finger at you and tell you what you're not doing right. And if you weren't on my back all the time, leave me alone. I've got this covered.
So that brings me – you were talking before about how you see yourself as a person who's got all the answers and wants to fix other people.
Mm.
Tell me about did you try to stop drinking or
probably not initially. I surrendered to the way I drank quite young, and that I saw that when I drank, I really struggled to do life in my own skin sober. I just didn't feel like I fit in. I didn't like it. And so alcohol fixed that problem I had. And if I could be a couple of drinks drunk all the time, I'd be a couple of drinks drunk all the time. But once I've had a couple, I keep going. I overshoot the mark. And so I guess I surrendered to the fact that I drink this way from 20, 22. And then what happened was that I just tried to manage the consequences of what happens when I drink. And go, actually, that requires me to be dishonest. That requires me to be selfish. That requires me to look after. And so I lie. Like the bit, I love the bit in the bit goes, don't believe anything I say. I really identify with that because I would say anything. And then I feel even worse about myself because I know I'm being dishonest. And so I feel even more guilt and I have to drink to get rid of that feeling. And so I'm stuck in this thing. It's this cycle completely of because of my behavior when I'm sober, I need to drink, and then I do stuff that I'm not happy about when I'm drinking, that I lie about, and it's just this constant, actually, dishonesty.
And
it's
a vicious circle, and we say that the disease is progressive, so that's the juice that's progressing it, isn't it?
Yeah.
The building shame, and then going to the what you said earlier, going to alcohol to fix your alcoholism.
I treat my alcoholism with alcohol. Alcohol, because the ism is the problem. The real issue isn't that when I drink it gets out of control. The real issue is that I drink Like, yeah. I know that. And I go, okay, so the solution to that problem of when a drinker gets out of control is I don't drink. If I don't drink, well, what happens when I don't drink is I'm sober all the time, yeah. 24 hours a day, mm-hmm. 7 days a week. And then I've got to front up and do normal human stuff, you know, take responsibility. And again, that letter's all about the things that don't mm-hmm. point out to me all the things that I don't do.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be pointing them out to me because I know
mm-hmm.
I'm not capable of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it's terrible.
All right, we'll have a little break. We'll be right back.
Rainbow United is a self-advocacy group that is run by and for LGBTQIA plus adults with intellectual disabilities and acquired brain injuries in Victoria. We get together online to fight for our rights, be in community and support each other. We meet fortnightly on Zoom. Reach out to us by email at hello@rainbowunited.org.au. Or go.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No, no, no. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the Sporting Record.
Or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball. Basketball.
Michael, when you were drinking, was there anything that your loved ones did do that helped you, or what did they do that made it worse?
I met a woman that told me she liked me, and that was enough. And I think she met me in the streets. I was living in a share house in Fitzroy, and she was managing bands at the time, and I don't know. She said, "You're an alcoholic, and I'm going to save you." And I went, "Yes."
Did she say that literally?
You bet, because she saw the way I drank and did drugs.
She literally said that to you.
And I went, "You beauty!" Like, this was it.
No, okay, stop. Why did you go, "You beauty"? You just thought, "Why?" Why?
I don't have found someone to look after me. It was lovely.
But so you didn't hear the bit where she said, "I'm going to." Oh, did she say, "I'm going to stop your drinking"?
No, she said she was going to save me.
Oh, even better. Yeah, by love.
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
I didn't ask her what her plan was. It just looked attractive.
Is this the woman that you had children with?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. All right. So how
And she enabled me for life. I mean, enabling is definitely an addictive term. We use it
enabling is an addictive behaviour.
Absolutely.
As much as drinking is, I'd say.
All the things that they said then in that letter was then, you know, she stopped. She made the phone calls to my work when I couldn't show up.
Yes.
She covered for me for her friends.
He's not feeling well.
He's not feeling well. Da da da. All the excuses and everything else. She held me off the ground. Actually, is what if I would have crashed, absolutely crashed onto the rocks of my life, coming out. I would have been in free fall for a long time, and she just kept putting the mattress down to catch me.
Yeah.
You know, and all the way along, when it looked like. I mean, I can't say that I would have got sober earlier if she hadn't. I just know that but she constantly held me off the ground,
mm-hmm.
and she took over the running of the house pretty mm-hmm. much. When I had to go back and make amends, I didn't have to. Speaking amends to her in sobriety, I had to own the fact that I was the extra child in the house. I was that, you know, that she was looking after three of us,
mm-hmm.
and my daughters and our daughters and me.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that was of no help to her. Even at the end, when I left that relationship, she went, "I could have left 20 years ago.
Oh, you bastard. You made me stay for 20 years.
Absolutely. And then I go, "There must have been a payoff for you."
Yeah.
And she absolutely she ran the place. It was a personality trait in her that was paid off in spades through having an alcoholic in her life.
Mm-hmm. Now we're laughing a little bit and stuff, but I know people right now that are in the grip of enabling.
Mm.
And it's often there's one particular case where it's a young person, mm-hmm. and it's opiates, and there is one person just enabling the hell out of him, and I can't do anything about that.
No.
And I'm a step removed anyway, but someone came to me advice about that, and I said, well, your sister needs to not enable. What's your advice? Well, when you say don't have a mattress under people, how do you do that when it's your child and it's opiates?
I don't know. I've actually had the same experience recently. We were getting a phone call from a guy who I'd been helping, from his mother. And he's saying, oh, you know, I see that so-and-so is spending $21.99 at the local supermarket every week, and I keep putting money in his bank account, and he hasn't got any petrol in his car. And she's living in the country, and he's living in Melbourne, and she's telling me all the things, and I go, stop putting the money in his account. Stop putting the money in his account, because if you keep it, because he's going to keep spending the money on alcohol. Yeah. And the expectation that he's not going to, because you keep throwing money at the problem. It's the same as people who, you know, mortgage their house or take money out of their superannuation to get their family members into rehabs in the belief that rehabs are the solution.
I know. So what do you got to say to them?
The fact that they need to come to the decision themselves that they want to stop.
Yep.
But that's a horrible thing to watch. Absolutely horrible thing to watch. I do the same with my teenagers, who are no longer teenagers, but when they were going through their own addictive behaviours, you know, I have one that was a self-harmer, and another one who's an overeater, and they, you know, they have their own lives. But to as a parent, to watch and go exactly what I read out before, and go, my motives are good, and if you only did life the way I've lived your life for you already. I've had, I can tell you this doesn't go a good way.
I know the answer. I know the outcome. So did you manage? Did you lapse into that, or did you manage to not to do that?
Oh, no, it's a constant battle to not be controlling around that stuff, because I care for them. I think that a sign of how much I love them is how much I control what they do, and that's just wrong. It's not the truth.
And I think the whole deal is take care of yourself first.
Yeah, you've got to be in a position to
take care of yourself, and then you're – do you think that is an Al-Anon we would offer? I think that's intrinsically helpful.
Yeah, it's like being in an aeroplane, isn't it? They, when the mast drops down, they tell you to take the air yourself before you're giving it to your child.
Yeah.
It's the same
stuff. But if I'm healthy and haven't gone down with the child and then the child comes back to me, the child's more likely to come back to me when they need real help.
No, you bet. Yeah, I was attracted to my sponsor because he'd kicked his teenage kid out of the house for a drug addiction because it was affecting all the other members of the household.
Mm.
And that's, I found that the ability to do that and the courage to do that, I mean, you're aware of their family. So that same stuff, it's hard. It's hard to make these really tough decisions about the people we care about, because it doesn't look like an act of love.
Certainly does not. And no, it does not look like an act of
love. Because it's this fear of what other people think.
Yeah.
This fear of judgment.
And the fear of the child getting dragged into crime and all sorts of worse things.
Oh, yeah. But there's all this fear that really I can't control one way or the other. I can't lock him in a room and I can't do anything about it.
And even if they're at home using drugs, it doesn't mean that you're saving them, because they're in a bedroom at your house.
It doesn't matter if it's gambling. You know, I speak to a few gamblers on this radio program, and I'm astounded. You know, I'm so glad I don't gamble, because I listen to it. It's all happening on a phone inside a bedroom, separated, you know, with the people who love them just on another side of the door, completely unaware.
Yeah, it's invisible in some ways.
Yeah, that's...
Yep.
Oh.
So can you describe how someone could love an alcoholic without taking responsibility for their sobriety, or how would it look?
How would it look? I think that eventually, I'm not sure, I'm actually really sure. I know that I've got to give it some thought now. I The separation, you call it detaching with love, don't you? This is the language in Al-Anon.
Detaching with love.
This ability to actually show the way you care through the responsible actions you're taking rather than the addictive actions that you take. Like being a grown-up, like I don't understand being a grown-up. That's the process of in recovery is to learn how to be a grown-up and growing up. But that ability to stand back and not be involved in every aspect. I've got even in the life of my teenagers to not be super involved when they were growing up. I can watch, I can do everything else, but I just can't control it. And this, it's such a challenge for anybody to go, actually, I'm going to show you how much I love you in these ways, and you'll have to trust that that's love.
I know, because it doesn't look like it, as you said before. Yeah.
It doesn't look like love because I should be wrapping them up in cotton wool, or I should be providing a soft landing, or I should be. But actually, my experience as the Alky is that I needed a really hard landing before I was willing to do anything. Because it wasn't until all the support structures were taken away that I crashed onto the ground and had to make a big decision. And the decision was, do I want to live or do I want to die? And then when the decision was mine to make, not forced on me, I will either make that decision or one way or the other. I will make that decision.
Mm.
And lots of people don't. They choose to not live.
Die.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the courage. What if your loved one, and especially your child, chooses not to live? Oh, my God.
Mm. Yeah, that's right.
This is what we're dealing with.
Yeah, it's life and death.
Yep.
I have an absolute understanding that recovery is about as a life and death decision.
Yep.
It doesn't matter whether you're doing it in Al-Anon or whether you're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise I go insane. Most alcoholics don't drink themselves to death. I was just having that conversation at the reception earlier. Most alcoholics don't get to a stage where they're dying of their drinking at 75 years old. Usually they've made a decision somewhere along the line that life has got so bad that they can't keep doing it.
Mm.
Yeah. And it sounds really trite, but I see the amount of trees out in the middle of nowhere, the side of a road that have got flowers at the bottom of them, and I go,
I know.
That was an alcoholic death.
Or
it could have been, that's in the middle of nowhere. And I know for me that I had a lot of thoughts about, I'm going to drive my car really fast into a very slow wall.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the best thinking I've got.
Mm-hmm.
But as a from the outside, I went to Al-Anon for a little while. I took my girls went to Alateen, and which is a support program for teenagers that have got an alcoholic in their lives, and because they had self-esteem problems and mental health problems that came out of my drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And they found it amazingly supportive to be able to detach themselves from they're not responsible.
Mm-hmm.
Then
they didn't cause it.
No, they didn't cause it.
Mm-hmm.
No, and I still I know that a personal story, but my my daughter, my youngest one, came out to me as gay, and she didn't want to do it because she was concerned that it would cause me to drink.
Oh God,
think that they're like that. That's that's her thinking.
Yeah, yeah, and it's normal. It's all normal.
Yeah,
it's all a normal response to an abnormal situation.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What else can I ask you? So, what did your the woman who so generously offered to look after you?
Yep.
How did that end up? Did she try to stop you drinking?
She just begged me, absolutely.
Just pleading.
Pleading and begging, and then she got angry, and then she, stopped having sex with me, and then she was, angry all the time when we were effectively separated in the house and living separate lives inside the same place. But she came from a cultural background where she wasn't going to leave. Like she came from a Southern European family background where, one person could live down on the Mornington Peninsula in a holiday house and the other one be living in Melbourne, but they're not separated.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she just never would have left. She would have punished me for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly how it felt when I first got sober.
Mm-hmm.
But she was angry. She was just so angry.
Mm-hmm. Because all that love she tried to give you, all that saving.
I was so unappreciative.
You were unappreciative and uncooperative.
And but I would never, you know, I didn't appreciate the amount of effort that she'd put in.
No.
She still doesn't believe it's her disease. She still thinks that if I loved her more, I would have stopped. She still believes if I loved our kids more, I would have stopped. She still has that belief system. She came to AA a few times with me when I got sober, and she sat there and she went, there's a real, I can feel the power in the room. And then she was really angry that I got sober for a bunch of strangers, but I wouldn't get sober for her. Mm-hmm. And if I loved her more, I would have. Mm-hmm. But yeah, she just begged and begged and begged. And in the end, I was so angrier with the way she nagged me. And I blamed her for lots of things that happened in our lives, so the decisions that she took on and in our family life. But if she didn't have private health insurance for us, like, I would never have got sober. Like, it's like I went to a rehab that, you know, I didn't know rehabs existed. I didn't have an experience with them. I didn't know anything about what recovery was or anything else. I just thought that my life was normal, that I wasn't very good at doing this life thing. It was probably my parents' fault. Yeah, it was probably, you know, I was raised by a, you know, a man-hating lesbian woman who, you know, I never had any men in my life. You know, I could sit there and point the fingers that all my relationships are ruined because of my mother, all this, and point the finger at all that stuff. And she and my wife, absolutely lovely woman, and I get along really well with her. And my ex-wife, I get along really well with her now. She just tried so hard, and the amount of energy she expended, and emotional energy, and
now she feels robbed.
It was a very cool conversation to go back and own that behaviour.
Now, tell me about that, the making of amends. Were you able to make direct amends to her?
Yeah, I guess amends is actually a process where we write down the harm that we've done, and we need to be really specific about the harms, and we think what we think they are.
Then we go and
because we never write, we'd never get them all. And then we book a time with the person and ask them if they're willing to hear the amends, and we go to them and we don't apologise because they've heard our apologies 100,000 times.
Oh, good point.
And so I go there and I say, I was wrong. I did this, and this. I don't tell her how I must have thought she was going to feel. I just say to her, I did this, I was wrong, I spent our money, I did this. And then I ask, and they're just words, and really they mean nothing to her because she's heard a lot of words before, but she's listening. It was really good. And then I ask at the end, I go, have I left anything out? Is there anything you'd like to say? And she went, yes. And she gave me 45 minutes of hell. Absolute hell. And she told my story back to me through her eyes and her experience, and it was gold. Mm-hmm. Like, it was absolute gold. And the man she described is not the man I thought that I was. Like, I had said I was wrong for a lot of things, but I don't know. I thought that I thought I drank her money. She goes, well, I went back to work, and I was, and after our second daughter was born, and I went back to work for 3 hours a day. It was from 6 o'clock at night to 9 o'clock at night, around the corner. In the afternoon. She went back in the afternoon. She goes, every time I had to drop our child at childcare, the child cried. I cried. I went to work. I came and picked the child up, and she cried again, and I cried, and I came back, and you know what? You drank that money. But the harm isn't that I drank her money. The harm is that I made her cry and I made our daughter cry, and then there was no benefit to them out of that, actually, the time that she took away from her child. And she just described a man that I never want to be. And so the process of the amends, I think I'm owning certain behaviours, but actually the fact is that I was the extra child in the family. I was inconsiderate. I was unloving. I was, you know, my experience in addiction is that my words say one thing, and my actions show them those people I say the words to something completely different. I say I love you, and then every action that I put in shows you that I don't. I say that you're important, and then actually everything I do shows you that you come second to alcohol,
which is a bit of a mind. F-U-C-K when you're on the other side.
Absolutely, because that letter you read out, my actions don't align with the words that come out of my mouth, because I'll say anything, anything to just to be able to get the next one in me, to get the next drink in me.
And you're saying it to someone who's primed, who's still got this optimism that maybe the next thing they do will fix it. So maybe they want to believe it because the next...
Oh, absolutely.
Because, he said he's going to do X, Y, and Z. Finally, now I've done it after all that sacrifice. And then, again, it doesn't happen. It's a bit crazy, isn't it?
Oh, and the worst thing as an alcoholic that we can probably do is to stop drinking for a period of time. And then give them more hope. And so relapse after 6 months or 12 months must kill. Like, I don't, that's not my experience. My experience is I haven't had a drink since I went to rehab. But then came out and joined Alcoholics Anonymous. But I watch it for people. They give them another hope. On the 121st chance, they got 6 months or 9 months or 12 months up and then went out again. And it's like that probably cuts deeper than even the drinking every day, because you've ignited some hope and the whole family and then gone, just swept, pulled the rug out from underneath them on this time. And, I said before the show that, I think that I've trained the people around me through my alcoholism. I train them to behave in a particular way. I train my kids not to trust me. I train them because I'm untrustworthy. And then I train them not to rely on me because I'm unreliable, and then I get angry because they don't trust me and they don't rely on me, and I think, oh, unappreciative little shits, and I can't see as the alcoholic, I can't see that it's my actions that make them act and feel this way, but they think this time they've got some. They think that if they just tried different, if my kids did their homework on time, but my kids in the end had no idea who was going to come in the door. They didn't know if I was going to shower them with gifts because I was feeling guilty, or if I was going to be picking the hell out of the little things they hadn't done around the house. And I create chaos and unpredictability.
Did you make amends to them too?
Certainly, two times actually. I did it when they were younger, when they were probably they were 11 and 8 when I got sober, and I did it again when I probably spoke an amends to them when they were, maybe 2 years, when I was 2 years in, and then I did it again when they were adults because it's two completely different conversations. And my kids asked me to be honest. Yeah, my kids, we're going to be on time, but for me, it's a really good story. I said to my kids, I walked out on my kids and my wife at a year sober, and it's a terrible decision I made, but it was completely selfish. I did it without, because I wasn't doing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was just not drinking.
And you're just turning up at the meetings.
And then, and I was 2 feet in the meetings, but I just hadn't changed my behavior. I hadn't changed the way I thought. But when I spoke that amends, I said, I was, I owned the behaviour. I wasn't around. I embarrassed them a lot when I was kids. Like, they've got videos of school school productions and everything else where their dad is the loud guy in the crowd because they served wine at halftime. And he could get 8 glasses in 20 minutes and no one else did. It wasn't a drinking function for anybody else. And so, woohoo, in the middle of the show when his daughters come on stage or standing in the front of a line at a netball presentation night and having a glass of red wine in my hand and trying to do the potato salad and spilling the red wine into the potato salad, and every person who got potato salad after me had red wine in their potato salad, and my kids knew it was me. And so I owned the embarrassing stuff, but they said that they wanted me to, their reply when I said, is there anything you'd like to say, they said, we want you to be honest with us every time we ask you a question. And what happened was that for the next 18 months, I was just transitioning into having my kids week on, week off with their mum. And they would go, Dad, do you like apples or oranges? And I go, I like oranges. Do you like monkeys or giraffes? And I'm, monkeys. Dad, if you came home and the cat was eating its food with a knife and a fork, what would you do? And I go, photograph and put it on Facebook. And then they asked me these dumb questions every time we were in the car, every time we were in the kitchen, every time I saw them for 18 months. And then 18 months after I'd spoken those words, they said, Dad, why'd you leave Mum? And it took them 18 months of testing me to see if I would be honest with them.
Came up with that. That was a natural thing.
They obviously been having a conversation with themselves, and eventually they asked me the question they really wanted to know the answer to, because they didn't trust me to be honest for 18 months, even though I said I was going to be.
And, but then they did.
And it's a really slow process to rebuild trust in families. And so from the other person's perspective, being in Al-Anon, to expect, you know, I can't expect that I'm going to rebuild my relationships as an alcoholic. I can't expect that I'm going to rebuild them overnight just because I'm not drinking.
Oh, God, said, no, because the other people are involved. I mean, they've got their own agenda, or they've got,
They've got to learn. It's got to be through my actions. And that's why I say with a men's process, it's really just words. Uh-huh. And they're not really interested in the words. They're really interested in the actions that follow up after the words and whether I'm going to follow through because I have a history of not following through. And I'm really grateful that I have, actually. I have really good relationships with my daughters. They're now 30 and 26 and living lives.
If you or someone you care for is struggling with a mental illness or other disability and you need someone to talk to, you can call the Wellways Helpline. Wellways Helpline is a volunteer support and referral service that provides information to people experiencing mental health issues or other disabilities, as well as their family, friends and carers. We're here to talk if you are feeling socially isolated, seeking information about mental health or mental health services, or just need someone to talk to. As a peer-based service, everyone working at Wellways Helpline has a lived experience of mental health issues or disability. Wellways Helpline is a national service and operates Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., excluding public holidays. So if you're struggling yourself or are struggling to help someone else, please call Wellways Helpline on 1-300-111-500. That's 1-300-111-500. Wellway supports 3CR.
Are you a 3CR subscriber?
We really need our listeners to subscribe to the station. It helps us remain financially independent and is an important part of our community governance.
It's just $40 concession, $80 waged, $150 for a band or organisation, and $300 solidarity.
Become a 3CR subscriber today.
3CR, Radical Radio.
This is the Living Free Show on 3CR 855 kHz on your AM radio dial and 3CR on digital radio. If you would like to listen to one of our many podcasts, then you can find us on your preferred podcast platform or just Google 3CR Living Free and check out our website. Today, Michael and I are chatting about living with the disease of alcoholism, both as the alcoholic and as a person close to the alcoholic. Michael, I'm just going to jump in with a broad sort of question. What would you say to someone who says to you, why don't you just stop?
Why don't I just stop? I wish I could. Like I've tried lots of ways to just stop. It's not that I don't see the consequences that of what happens when I drink. It's, you know, I knew that my wife was on the verge of leaving. She wouldn't have, but she threatened it and threatened it and threatened it. I knew it was costing me work. I knew it was costing my relationships, but I. And no matter what that consequence is, that I guess I've found out in AA that actually no amount of consequence can stop me because I suffer from. The problem isn't that when I drink it gets out of control. The problem is that I have an obsession with alcohol that leads me back to picking it up. I've never picked up the first drink drunk. I only pick up the first drink stark raving sober. Stark raving sober. And I get into there is this cycle of addiction, and I think it works for all. It doesn't have to be alcohol, it could be any sort of addiction, that I come off the bender, I come off the spree or whatever of doing the behavior. I make some firm promises, but due to the guilt, shame and remorse, I make some firm promises about that's not happening again, because I really suffer from the agains. Oh my God, I've done it again. So I make some firm promises, and then I sit in this nice time span, it says on the cycle, and eventually I get restless, irritable and discontent, and I get uneasy and underappreciated and usually that happens when I run into other people. Like I have this, the problem is obviously other people, and they don't do what I think they should, and they're not, and they don't treat me right, and I get into this stage and I start rethinking things and having those stories going on in my head. And then I've got this negative self-talk that's happening all the time in the back of my head, telling me that I'm not good enough and that you're never going to be successful and you're never going to make this work and you're never going to be right at this life and you're never going to fit in. And this voice that's going and going and going. And if people saw the inside of my head, they would never doubt why I drank. No. And because Mike's alcohol shuts that voice up really well, just for and but I then get into this debate, you know, from this restless, irritable, discontent stage where I go, I could have a drink and that'll fix that. And I go, yeah, but just a couple of drinks, take the edge off. And then my head goes, actually, you've promised those people you won't do that, and you've promised yourself, so you really shouldn't do that. And then I get into, you know, I might go for a few more days or might be a few more minutes, and then I get back to that stage of, I'm uneasy again. I'm not sitting in my own skin. I really feel anxious, and, oh, I could just take the edge off, and I start thinking about drinking again. And all of a sudden, eventually, and I was having a conversation with a sponsor yesterday about in every barrel of no's, there's a yes. And I might go to the barrel and pull the ball out and go, oh, no, no. And it might take, if there's 100 balls in the barrel, there might be on the 100th time I pick it up.
Yeah.
But it might be the first time I pick it up. And it's just, I have this obsession, this brain that tells me that next time it's going to be different, or that I just forget. I have a really good forgettery, and that it's going to be different. And the mental obsession just drives me. Eventually I pick up a drink and I get back on that cycle of put it in me. And so the idea that I just won't drink, I've tried that. I just won't drink. And I last 4, 5, 6 days. And then I go, I can't be an alcoholic because I haven't had a drink for 6 days.
So I might just have a celebratory drink.
I have a drink. and the first time I pick up a drink, it might only be 2 drinks. But then the next time it'll be, oh, if I got away with 2 of them, then I should be fine. Not even got away. I had 2 drinks last night, so I'm fine. So why wouldn't I drink today? And why wouldn't I drink the day after?
So that mental obsession, is that at the bottom of things almost?
That's the problem.
That's the problem?
The problem. The physical thing that makes me different to other people, in that when I put it in, I have a physical allergy or my body reacts different to alcohol to normal people. That thing will never be fixed. I'll always have that. The problem is this mental obsession. The mental problem is the state of mind that leads into picking up the drink. I have no defense against the first drink. Actually, the language in the book says, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. And there's also a bit, and I read it here with somebody yesterday. Oh, where is it? No, I do want to find it.
No, you find it.
The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first one. And that's the real issue. It isn't that when I drink it gets out of control. It's that when I'm sober, I can't not drink.
So can you tell me about what that mental obsession, where are you with that now in recovery?
Oh, so that's what Alcoholics Anonymous treats. It treats when I get to that stage of restless, irritable discontent, so I'm always going to get to that stage. It's a natural part of being, of living. So, you know, if I'm not restless, irritable, discontent, then I'm not really a active member of my workplace. If I'm not restless, irritable, and discontent, then I'm not actually in an intimate relationship. That stuff just is normal.
Are you saying normal for the whole population?
Oh, the whole population. It's a human, everybody. Human condition. Yeah, everybody gets it where it doesn't go their way and they start. And so AA treats what I do with that. When I get into that state where the world isn't treating me right, da da da, when I start getting the self-pity, when all the little things like that, AA gives me a process of actually looking at that actually the problem is me. I'm not fitting in because I'm not flexible. I'm being selfish. I'm being dishonest. I've done something. My problems are of my own making. And so whilst I'm treating that, I never get to the yes-no questions of whether I should drink or not. And AA's whole program is about keeping me in this, life's happening. And how am I going to...
What am I going to do to
stay in the stream of life rather than be pushing uphill all the time or banging into walls? Yeah. Or how will I take a different perspective? And it doesn't come natural because I've spent my whole of my drinking career being selfish and dishonest. It's not my go-to behaviour to go, actually, what I'm going to do is try and see it from your perspective. And if I could see it from your perspective, maybe I'd see that maybe you just had a day. Maybe you just had...
I don't think that's natural to anyone on the planet. That's not how we're wired. So that's why you got to keep going to the meetings and practicing it.
Well, for normal people, it doesn't really matter. For alcoholics, they may be able to find ways. They might go to gym. They might find other ways. They might just be miserable. But I can't do life miserable because what happens is I drink, and to drink is to die. Mm-hmm. And so it's a life and death decision of whether or not to actually. And that's why. I do have some choices. I have self-will. Self-will isn't about whether or not I drink and the amount of willpower I apply to that. Am I willing to do the program that Alcoholics Anonymous outlines, which might require some meditation, some prayer, some interaction and a lot of connection with other people, listening to other people, which I'm terrible at. Because I like to talk, and all the things that if I keep connected to others, that stuff I can apply my will to.
And you can apply your will, don't you reckon, to one day at a time. You can apply your will to cooking the dinner, just doing the next normal thing. You don't need to be solving your whole life problem all at once.
No, keep it in the moment and be present with the people when you're there. Now, little things like when I'm with my family members, I take my phone and I put it away and so I don't get interrupted and I go, actually, you've got my full attention. Mm-hmm. And just those are just little disciplines that actually allow me to be connected to others and then they feel connected to me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I fit in. And
you're in the stream of life.
You bet. I don't feel the need.
All right. We've got to get out of here for Bale and Wah, who are here. I just saw them walk past. So, Michael, can you just give us a one sentence? Or not? You can give you more than one sentence. But just a little message to someone out there that's completely engrossed in trying to get someone to stop drinking today.
Oh, no, I'd let him hit the ground hard and trust that it's actually going to be okay. I think that even most of us have lived our lives and look back and go, oh, that hasn't really worked out real well in some way. Yeah. But something's looked after us to get us to where we are, and maybe that same power is willing to look after the person we care about the same way.
Beautiful. Let them hit the ground hard. And realise that life's probably got them. Something's got them. They'll be fine.
And there's a power greater than themselves that can help them with that.
Yeah. All right. This was the Living Free Show on 3CR Digital Radio and live streaming on 3cr.org.au/streaming. That's all we've got time for. Thank you for coming in to the Al-Anon Show, Michael.
Oh, wow. Thanks for inviting me.
If you're concerned about drinking in a relative or friend and would like to find out more about Al-Anon, you can contact them on 1-300-252-666 or go to alanon.org.au. If you're concerned about your own drinking, AA is on 1-300-222-222 or go online to aa.org.au. Coming up next, we have Bale and Wah, hosted by Uncle Teljum. Seen Uncle Teljum, I think, or at least Gavin walking past the door. So thanks for listening to Living Free. Enjoy Bale and Wah. Stay safe and stay tuned now for more Radical Radio.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.